Blog Talk Radio.
Comes to show the
The lack of transparency will do the president in one way or another. This might be the final nail in the coffin for the White House, restoring any credibility with the people. What do you think? When the president wants to get into our lives and our political lives, the same president who wants to monitor our transactions in real time, when we buy a gun and stick their gun down their
hands down
our
pants,
they want to know what is good for the goose is good for the gander. If we cannot have cameras during White House briefings, then the TSA should turn off the body scanners taking pictures of my nude body and get their hands out of my pants. I like this guy. I don't even know what it is. Watching Texas politics. I don't know. It doesn't say what blog that is.
Uh-uh. Can you go up a little more?
No. Lone Star Watchdog. Lone Star Watchdog is the name of this. Absolutely amazing. This I wanted to go back up here because this stuff was discussed really shocking.
I don't even know what you're talking about. What stuff?
This right here. Webster Tarpley. And I'm going to play this one. Also, in a little while, we have time, because that doesn't
actually... Well, people don't know what you're talking about.
Amazing speech by a war veteran. Right? In fact, I might play it now, because, you know, these wars and this atrocities that are happening, and this guy makes a lot of sense right here. All right? And he's a veteran. Talking about the racism, talking about the war in Iraq.
Go ahead, play it. And
he's right on the money.
And I tried hard to be proud of my service, but all I could feel was shame. And racism could no longer mask the reality of the occupation. These were people. These were human beings. I've since been plagued by guilt anytime I see an elderly man, like the one who couldn't walk, who we rolled onto a stretcher and told the Iraqi police to take him away. I feel guilt anytime I see a mother with her children, like the one who cried hysterically and screamed that we are worse than Saddam as we forced her from her home. I feel guilt anytime I see a young girl, like the one I grabbed by the arm and dragged into the street. We were told we were fighting terrorists. The real terrorist was me, and the real terrorism is this occupation. Racism within the military has long been an important tool to justify the destruction and occupation of another country. It has long been used to justify the killing, subjugation, and torture of another people. Racism is a vital weapon employed by this government. It is a more important weapon than a rifle, a tank, a bomber, or a battleship. It is more destructive than an artillery shell, or a bunker buster, or a Tomahawk missile. While all those weapons are created and owned by this government, they are harmless without people willing to use them. Those who send us to war do not have to pull a trigger or lob a mortar round. They do not have to fight the war, they merely have to sell the war. They need a public who is willing to send their soldiers into harm's way. They need soldiers who are willing to kill and be killed without question. They can spend millions on a single bomb, but that bomb only becomes a weapon when the ranks of the military are willing to follow orders to use it. They can send every last soldier anywhere on earth, but there will only be a war if soldiers are willing to fight. And the ruling class, the billionaires who profit from human suffering, care only about expanding their wealth, controlling the world economy. Understand that their power lies only in their ability to convince us that war, oppression, and exploitation is in our interest. They understand that their wealth is dependent on their ability to convince the working class to die to control the market of another country. And convincing us to kill and die is based on their ability to make us think that we are somehow superior. Soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen have nothing to gain from this occupation. The vast majority of people living in the U.S. have nothing to gain from this occupation. In fact, not only do we have nothing to gain, but we suffer more because of it. We lose limbs, endure trauma, and give our lives. Our families have to watch flag-draped coffins lowered into the earth. Millions in this country without health care, jobs, or access to education. Let's watch this government squander over $450 million a day on this occupation. Poor and working people in this country are sent to kill poor and working people in another country to make the rich richer. future. And without racism, soldiers would realize that they have more in common with the Iraqi people than they do with the billionaires who send us to war.
Conspiracy.
Yeah, this is very, very good, and I hope you listen to it. Here we go. College Conspiracy.
From the time an American child reaches the sixth grade, they are taught that the key to success in life is to do well in high school so that they can get accepted to the best possible college. The better grades they get in high school, the better college they will have an opportunity to get into. They are taught that if they get into a great college and get their college degree, any type of job they desire in the field of their choice will be there waiting for them. After getting their dream job, they will be able to buy any car and house they desire, start their own family, and live the American dream. Most Americans today have an expectation of future economic success simply by obtaining a college degree. The entire purpose of elementary school is to prepare students for high school, and the entire purpose of high school is to prepare students for college. In fact, the U.S. now has hundreds of private college preparatory high schools that, at a cost of $25,000 per year, are supposed to increase students' chances of getting into a top-tier college. Students are taught to believe that if they don't go to college, they will be on a path to nowhere and will have no chance of ever building a successful career. Government regulations like No Child Left Behind have left grade and high schools in shambles. Instead of teachers having the freedom to think outside the box and use creative techniques to prepare their students for the real world, they are forced to be narrow-minded and teach with worthless information that will never help their students have successful careers. Today, there are no high schools left in America that teach students the knowledge necessary to start their own business, invent their own product, or even how to use the internet and other free resources to become educated about things without attending college. The annual cost to attend the average private four-year college in America today is $27,293, up 29% from 5 years ago during the 2005-2006 school year when the annual tuition cost $21,235. This does not include the cost of textbooks, which have tripled over the past decade. Colleges are now charging $200 for each single textbook that has no resale value because they put out new, slightly revised versions with a new name each year. The textbook publishers are even colluding with college bookstores to make custom textbooks so the students can't save money by buying them online. Colleges are getting kickbacks from publishers in order to destroy the used textbook market, which by itself is proof enough that college administrators are only interested in lining their own pockets and have no interest in helping their students.
They write in textbooks, but they brainwash you from a little kid up so that you buy into the system and you get good grades and you study hard and then you become a member of total system, no freedom. You don't know how to think because they told you how to think their way.
College tuition has seen 5.15% annual price inflation over the past 5 years. This is despite the fact that U.S. real estate prices are down 26% from their peak in July of 2006, and the Dow Jones is down 18% from its peak in October of 2007. Even oil is down 38% from its peak in July of 2008. During the financial crisis of 2008, Americans lost $10.2 trillion in paper wealth. And college is the only thing in America, besides the cost of health care, that did not at least temporarily decline in price.
Inflation has made it impossible. Again, when I was a kid, it wasn't, you never heard parents saying, we're planning and putting money away for your education because it's going to cost us $100,000 And we have to keep putting that money away so that when you graduate, not only will you not pay us back, you're not even going to get a job.
Over just a two-year period from December of 2007 through December of 2009, 8,363,000 jobs in America were lost, or 6.1% of total jobs. 1 year later, in December of 2010, thanks to the federal... Reserve and the U.S. government spending $4.6 trillion on bailouts, stimulus programs, and other government spending, 1.124 million jobs in America, or 0.9% of total jobs, have been recovered. That is over $4 million spent for each job created.
As we move into deeper into this Great Recession, that we believe as inflation continues to skyrocket, the reality of a Great Depression will come in because people will realize that all that worthless money you have can't buy you much of anything. You're going to see more and more people, as they're already doing it, believing that they're, by going to college, it's going to be their passport to the future. It's not what it used to be. A degree, a college degree, a BS, what does that buy you? And I love the mentality. The mentality is this, that corporations and businesses won't hire a person unless they get a degree. Not me. I don't care if you have a degree. It makes absolutely no difference. I want you to have a mind, be able to think for yourself and think on your feet. Be energetic and love what you're doing and have a passion in so many different other ways. Not to be able to just regurgitate what you're being told. And that's all it's come to. It's regurgitation.
During an economic downturn when Americans are losing their jobs, their primary instinct is to seek higher education in order to make themselves more attractive to potential employers and better position themselves to receive a job. However, how are Americans supposed to spend $27,293 per year for college when they have no savings or income to pay for it? The U.S. government, with the backing of the Federal Reserve, in the same way they created the real estate bubble, by providing mortgages to all Americans through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, regardless of whether or not they had any capacity to pay the loans back, has been using the exact same easy lending practices to create one of the largest bubbles in U.S. history, the college bubble. College students borrowed $106 billion in total student loans for the 2009-2010 school year, up from $96 billion in 2008-2009, $94 billion in 2007-2008, $87 billion in 2006-2007, and $83 billion in 2005-2006. Total student loan debt in the U.S. currently stands at $830 billion and now exceeds credit card debt.
I was so pro-education. That's all I wanted in my life was an education. And you know, I'd like to still be pro-education,
right,
but to put anybody through what I've been through, no. Really, in my case, the education, I think, really ruined my life. So, I mean, I would have been better off if I just would have gone to work at, you know, McDonald's or something, actually. So,
that is unbelievable.
So this is a debt I can never get over.
I just posted this to my Facebook.
Yeah.
So anyone who's listening to this on Facebook, please... you can go to it under
and
Leo.
And watch the rest of it?
Yeah, under Leo Steele.
How much more of that is there?
It's an hour long.
Oh, it's quite a long.
It's a documentary.
I think it's
very,
worth
very good.
Listening to.
Yeah, it is. It's just it's very, very good. And I highly recommend it. If you're planning college, you know, unbelievable. Anyway, let's see.
more videos on Diana's death.
Okay, TSA's backscatter radiation safety tests were rigged. It's now will be revealed by Natural News that the TSA faked its safety data on its X-ray airport scanners in order to deceive the public about the safety of such devices. As evidenced by recent events in Washington, we now live in an age where the federal government simply fakes whatever documents, news, or evidence it wants people to believe, then releases that information as if it were fact. This is the modus operandi of the Department of Homeland Security, which must fabricate false terror alerts to keep itself in business. And now the TSA division has taken the fabrication of false evidence to a whole new level with its naked body scanners. That's from Natural News.
The evidence of the TSA fakery is now obvious thanks to the revelations of letter signed by five professors from the University of California, San Francisco, and Arizona State University. To this day, there's been credible scientific evidence testing of the TSA's naked body scanners. The claimed safety of the technology by the TSA is based on rigged tests. The testing that did take place was done on a custom combination of spare parts rigged by the manufacturer of the machines and didn't even use the actual machines installed in the airports. In other words, the testing was rigged. The names of the researchers who conducted the radiation test at RapidScan have been kept secret. This means the researchers are not available for scientific questioning of any kind, and there's been no opportunity to even ask why they are qualified to conduct.
And let's not forget that those people in the TSA are Israeli, all right? It's an Israeli-owned company, all right? These scanners, Chertoff, that son of a bitch Chertoff, okay, used to be the Homeland Security guy under Bush, okay, heavily invested in these scanning machines, okay, and is also a TSA board member.
None of the rapid scan tests have been available to be subjected to peer review. They are quite literally secret tests. Using secret techniques engineered by secret researchers, we the people apparently have no right to see the data, nor the methodology, nor even the names of the researchers who supposedly carried out these safety tests. The final testing report has been so heavily redacted that there is no way to repeat any of these measurements, says the professors. In other words, the testing violates the very first tenet of scientific experimentation, which is that of all experiments must be repeatable in order to be verified as accurate. As the professor states in the letter, the document is heavily redacted with red stamps over the words and figures. In every case, the electric current used, which correlates one-to-one with X-ray dose, has been specifically redacted. Thus, there is no way to repeat any of these measurements while the report purports to present the results of objective testing. In fact, the JHU APL personnel who were unnamed anywhere in the document, either as experimenters or authors, were not provided with the machine by RapidScan. Instead, they were invited to the manufacturing site to observe a mock-up component that was said to be similar to those that are parts of the RapidScan system. The tests were performed by the manufacturer using the manufacturer's questionable test procedures.
You got that? Where is the outrage from the scientific community on all this? This quack science, this TSA testing, is so atrociously and inexcusably bad that if this fabricated evidence were presented at any sort of scientific meeting, they would be laughed off the stage and publicly vilified in the media. And yet somehow, when the TSA engaged in this sort of quack science, virtually the entire scientific community says nothing. Only a small group of especially courageous scientists has stood up to this obvious quackery. And even these professors are, of course, being blasted in the press and called un-American for merely questioning an obviously flimsy evidence being laughably fronted by the TSA.
Well, I think people get the
gist
of this article. It's quite a long one, but it's really.
I want you to go to this, please. I hope you. It's a great article. It's by NaturalNews.com. It's called the TSA Backscatter Radiation Tests Were Rigged.
by and, Mike Adams.
Right. Check
the
it
health
out. Check it out. If this doesn't piss you off, I don't know what will, folks. So, you know, nothing will, I guess. So, anyway, we have our guest with us tonight, and our guest is Tom Paine.
The author of The Template of Time.
Our Destiny Decoded. And I'll have Tom explain what the book is, but it's great. We've had Tom on a number of times. And
but we wanted to remind you about him and about his book and about his...
And I'll just read this quick intro for him here. It says, it's actually on the back of his book. It's called The Bible's Hidden Time Code Holds the Answers to Some of Life's Greatest Questions, such as what is our destination and when will we get there? In The Template of Time, Tom Paine relies on 8 years of intense research as he shares a comprehensive chronological study of the quirky time patterns scattered throughout the Bible that, when assembled, create an eternal template upon which history unfolds. And just as atmospheric patterns suggest tomorrow's weather forecast, the historical patterns of the template suggest future outcomes while ruling out coincidence and chance. Tom right now on the air. Hey, Tom, are you with us?
Hey, yes, I'm like, can you hear me?
Yeah, very well. Can you hear us all right?
Excellent, fine.
Oh, good, good, okay. Yeah, Tom, maybe you can tell the people, I tried to read a little excerpt here from the back of your book, but maybe just give us the listeners an idea of what your book is about and how you created it, actually.
Okay, first of all, I would encourage every listener to immediately buy the book because the world is supposed to end in about 4 days, I think. So that's the most important thing, although my book did not predict that. Now, the template. Go ahead.
I just said that's very comforting that your book didn't predict that.
Go ahead.
If there's one thing about these predictions of the end of the world that you can virtually be certain of, is that they're gonna be in that same long list of people who've gotten it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, he guessed the end of the world in 1994, and now it's supposed to be 2011.
I remember the Millerites. Do you remember the Millerites?
Yes.
Very famous group of followers of Miller. I forget his first name, but he predicted the world would end in in 1900, I believe, was his prediction. And of course, 1900 came and went, and his organization kind of crumbled. And I remember him saying, I miscalculated. It was 1905 or 1902, or you know what I mean. And he held they held on for a couple of years, but then they finally broke up. But that was a very famous misquote or misstatement, rather.
Well, anyway, Tom, maybe you could let our listeners know once again, remind them of what your formula is for predicting important events that have happened.
But since we since you brought that up, though, about the 521, maybe using your book and your examples, maybe you can explain to people why that is such a why there's no real proof or evidence or anything to back up his statement.
Sure, I've never seen this man's mathematical model for doing this, but basically the template's real simple. It's got three components. There are time cycles. And if you look at the ages of the patriarchs, or Methuselah, for example, did he really live to be 969 years old? Did Isaac live to be 180 years? Possibly. God's capable of anything. But I think that they are also important numbers for being time cycles. These time cycles then need to extend from something. And they extend from three dates in the life of Jesus. His birth year, which you would probably expect since the calendar start there. And then it extends from the other two big moments of his life, because most of his life is unrecorded. You have his birth, And then all of a sudden he explodes on the scene with the baptism by the Holy Spirit. He launches his ministry as the Messiah. And then you have the end of his career, which comes with this cataclysmic end with his crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension. And so those 3 years, the year of his birth, the year of the start of his ministry, and the year of his resurrection are the time cycles extend from those three time points. And what happens when you extend them from those three time points, they create a sequence of events. So let's say the time cycles equal 1,980 years if you added them all up, and that would be the 180-year time cycle times 11. The 1,980 years you extended from his birth year, that's 6 BC, and I can go into why it's 6 BC, or I just recommend people go to the website. It has the reasoning behind all of this. But if you extend it from the birth year of 6 BC, you come 1980 minus 6 is 1974. So you have all these events that would be started around that time period, which should then move in a new direction about 32 years later and then culminate about 4 years after that. So you see 1974, 2006, and 2010 create these sequences of events, and one of them led to the prediction that Mubarak would be out of office around the year 2010. Because the sequences lined up, all the historical activity suggested that. And one other thing that was suggested by it, for you have in 1973 the Yom Kippur War. Basically, Israel was hit by a surprise attack by Egypt and Syria. And based on, since that's around that 1974 date, I looked for new directions around the year 2006 to see if perhaps Israel would be the aggressor. And certainly they were the aggressor towards Syria around 2006. They invaded Lebanon and attacked their proxy army, the Hezbollah, in 2006. But in 2007, they even invaded Syria and bombed out their nuclear facilities. So what this pointed to is a greater war between Syria and Israel around the year 2010. And all the things, and also with Egypt, because Egypt was a part of that group back then. Well, that meant that if Egypt is going to be at war with Israel, then there couldn't be Mubarak in power. And as I looked at the dates of history, it showed that, no, it looked like he would be out of power. And indeed, he has been. And the second part of it is he's been replaced by some virulently anti-Israeli politicians who are likely to win, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Hmm. Now, this mathematical formula to predict some important events for the future? And have you done that? And what dates do you think are worth watching?
And also, do you think that do we hold anything more in 2011? And especially, does anything coincide with 2012? Any major events?
Well, you know, these dates. For example, you notice that 1973 was not exactly 1974, and the invasion of Syria in 2007 was not exactly 2006. So these dates are within typically 1 to 3 years of the actual events occurring, and most typically within 1 or 2 years. So you would expect the things that began around 1974 to achieve their culmination by the year 2012. And there were so many big things that occurred around 1974 that I think 2012 will be an extraordinarily dynamic time period. But
you know,
I don't think.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You just brought up 1974. I was thinking of the resignation of Nixon. All right, the impeachment of Nixon. And
absolutely.
Could we see that again?
Well, you know what you would look for. What you would look for is the resignation of Nixon could possibly lead to a resignation by a future president, which in this case would have to be Obama. But you would need a new direction, something, some seed-like new movement that occurs approximately 4 years before that happens. So sometime around 2008, did something happen that would necessitate or lead toward this sort of resignation? That is a possibility.
You got the Tea Party movement. You got the Ron Paul. You got Ron Paul people, and they started up back then. So 4 years ago, there were some interesting things going on politically.
Yes, you may be onto something. I haven't looked at that one, but I do know that it was one of the more important events that occurred around that time period, as was the Vietnam War and its ending, and the restoration of relations with Vietnam that also unfold on this template, with our recognition of them and things of that sort.
And you know, what's interesting too is that the announcement of the end of the Iraqi War, all right, was in 2010.
Yes, remember? I think that what you're looking at all sorts of important things that are going to occur in that Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan theater, because if you look around, there was another important time cycle launched around 1978. Okay, well, 32 years later, you go into the new direction phase. Well, in around 78, you had, well, it was 1979, but the Ayatollah Khomeini comes into power, Saddam Hussein comes into power. You had the Soviet Union invade Afghanistan, and I think that you had the assassination of Benazir Bhutto's father by Zia-ul-Huq, who was a military dictator. And some of the things that this is pointing to, in my estimation, what I point to is a change of government, more than likely, in Iraq. And currently, it's a democracy. I see that thing being swept aside.
You also had the Iraq war, which killed millions of people in 79, I believe.
Yes, and there could be a re-engagement of hostilities between these two, because there's certainly a power play by Iran to assert itself throughout the region. And what's interesting to me, though, and this is something that I predicted in the book, is you will have a change of leadership in Iran, that this Ayatollah Khomeini, who's now in power and is currently in a big power struggle with Ahmadinejad, that he will, whether he loses this power struggle or not, he will be out of power. It could be that he dies of natural causes, any number of different things. But there's going to be a change in leadership.
I just read recently that Ahmadinejad is under severe pressure to resign. So
I would not doubt that. You know, what you could have is him doing some sort of coup through using the thugs that seem to support him, or who knows what. But I do show Khomeini leaving power.
Do you have any, through your mathematical formula, do you have any financial predictions?
What could happen in the next 6 months or so, or year?
Well, that's an unfortunate one. You see, you had the Arab oil embargo that happened around 73. After we supported Israel, the Arab nations said, we're not supporting you, so they had the oil embargo. And that created a really bad recession in the United States, and the stock market tanked like we haven't seen it for a long time until just recently. Then you had, and so that's one time period that reaches its culmination around the year 2010. You also had in 78, the one where you'll have the new direction in 2010, we had the another oil problem when Iran was taken over by the Ayatollah. Prices spiked, and it led to another recession that was even longer and deeper than the one that we had with the Arab oil embargo. So you have those two recessionary movements converging on the year 2010. So it points to another massive spike in the oil price and another recession. And that's something that I've been predicting for a while. And I think it will be caused by an Israeli strike of the Iranian nuclear facilities and Iran trying to shut down the Straits of Hormuz.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned that last time you were on, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be amazing.
When do you think that could possibly take place?
I would expect it to be sometime this year or next. It may be 2013 at the latest, but I don't think it'll be that long. You know, Israel is probably feeling more fenced in and threatened than they've ever felt for the last 36 years. They have the problems that are emerging in Egypt, where it's likely the Muslim Brotherhood will secure many of the elected offices. You've got Syria, which is in a state of ferment, and either they're going to distract their own people from what they're doing to their people by starting aggression against Israel, or maybe Assad is overthrown by somebody who's even more anti-Israeli. And you've got all these different things coming together at once, and you've got Iran, that's the nuclear threat. Israel is not real happy right now.
Oh, boy.
So, well, that's I can understand that. And most people aren't very happy with Israel right now either. So, but I was curious, what do your predictions state about Israel? I mean, Israel is supposed to be destroyed again, is it not?
And there are some who would posit that, and you know, based on prophecy, this, that, and the other, I believe that Israel will win these first rounds with Syria and Egypt, but after that, things are going to become complicated because thing that I think people are not looking at but need to be mindful of is I don't think the threat is to the United States or much of the world is Middle Eastern. I think it's the emergence of a centralized and militarized European Union. That is one of the things that the template is pointing toward.
And what is the effect of that, do you think? What could be the effect of that? Is that in competition with the United States?
Certainly, but you know, the problem with the European Union that's centralized, and it's the weakness that plagued Napoleon and everyone else except for the English, is they have no naval power. They can't project their power beyond land bridges. So those who they're connected with by land or who are just across the lake from them in like Mediterranean Lake, then they can project their power there, but otherwise they have great difficulty projecting their power. So the United States in all this, I think, is going to be secure. But they will probably be projecting their power to the south and to the east for mineral wealth, oil, and things of that sort, because that's what they lack. And they were almost held hostage by the Russians not too long ago with natural gas pipelines being shut off in the wintertime. So I would expect them to want to secure that by taking over and fighting with weaker countries.
Do you believe that? Do you think that Fukushima? Did you foresee any kind of major environmental disaster? Disasters happening around this time?
No, I did not. I certainly would have taken credit for it if I had, but no, I that was a big surprise to me. But you know, the world of history has so many surprises in store for us that I'll be shocked probably almost daily.
But actually, in Revelation and in the Bible, they quote the end time would be a time of floods and earthquakes and fires and wars and all the reports of these things. And that's now, man. If there's ever been a time where we've seen natural catastrophes, it's now in the last year. Is there any timetable? Like, you know, when was the last time the Earth ever went through this kind of upheaval? And as far as I know, it was similar in about 25,000 years ago when the last polar shift occurred. All right.
Prediction's sake, one of the things in this template, you know, there are these different cycles, the first cycle, fourth cycle, seventh cycle, and just to keep it simple, things that started around the 1774, 1806, 1810 sequence of events, usually they foreshadow something that will come to a culmination in the sequences that started in 1984 and 1994. So one of the things that happened on that 1806 time frame, 1806, 1810, was the New Madrid Fault and the earthquake that occurred, where it was, I think, a series of three or four earthquakes that occurred around that year. It rerouted the Mississippi. It was just an enormous cataclysm for that area. Because it wasn't so heavily populated, it didn't result in that many deaths. But here's the strange thing about the template. Those things that occur in the fourth cycle, or around 1806, 1810, are usually weak and insignificant in comparison to the things that culminate in the seventh cycle, which we're now in. So the important dates of that seventh cycle would be, is it the 84 time frame, will go in a new direction around 2016, culminate around 2020, and the 1994 sequence will go in a new direction in 2026 and culminate in 2030. So around those dates, I would anticipate the United States possibly receiving some, have some massive earthquake.
So, yeah.
Well, that's something to keep in mind anyway, isn't it?
But you're thinking 2030 might be the latest, right?
Yeah, because these things that started in the fourth cycle achieved their culmination in the seventh cycle, and the seventh cycle has two sequences of events associated with it. So, you know, I can't be more specific than that, other than I just think that. But here's the thing that we'll know if it's a fulfillment of this whole template of time. Those New Madrid earthquakes were massive, and this one should dwarf those if it's a fulfillment.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty scary.
There was something else I wanted to ask you about that. In 2012, all right, 2011 to 2012, they're talking right now that the Ring of Fire, which is the ring of earthquakes, okay, the ring of the continental shelf, which is around California, all right,
uh-huh.
And it goes from California to Hawaii and so on and so forth. There's an area there that they predict the next earthquake is going to major earthquake is going to be within that ring of fire, they call it, and that may happen within the next year. Do you see anything that I mean, seismologists, yeah, they're watching these things. And because even now in the Pacific, a lot of the Pacific island volcanoes in Hawaii and so on and so forth are becoming active again or are creating much more activity. And this is one of the seismologists.
There's a lot of talk about that.
There's a whole lot of talk about the possibility of an earthquake, the size we've never seen before, along that area. Which is right around California, Washington State, I think, California. It's a circle there. It's called a circle of fire. Right. But
anything to indicate any happenings there?
Anything in the next year that you know would correspond with your template?
Were there any major earthquakes that occurred in that area around 1974? That would be something that might point toward it. But
the last one in San Francisco where all the highways collapsed. When was that?
Ooh, geez, I don't know.
That was
1908 or something was the San Francisco earthquake, but the one St. Helena was in 1980 or 81 or something like that. On St. Helen.
The only thing that I'm coming up with would be those dates that I gave you before, the 2016,
right.
2020, and so that could happen. And usually it's within a couple of years of it, so maybe 2014 or 2018, but that's one of the times when I would think it would occur, or the 2026, 2030 time period.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I remember in the book there was that one- or two-year lag time between the periods. The last question I have for you, and it really is the when the Roman Empire fell, which was what, going back to my history, somewhere in the around one, what was it?
476 AD for the West Roman Empire, and
right.
1453 AD for the East Roman Empire.
Okay. Any trend? Any signs or any not signs, but any signs or anything in your template that predicted? I mean, that was a major event. I mean, the decline of that civilization, or that empire. Anything that could be carried over to the, you know, to now, and the major empires.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the book, The Template of Time, one of the major themes it looks at is the Roman Empire, which is the fourth kingdom of Daniel and the prophet Daniel. And the Roman Empire goes through many transformations. It became a Christian empire, then it became the Holy Roman Empire, and finally the Holy Roman Empire was done away with, and it became a secular empire united through conquest of arms by Napoleon, who destroyed the Holy Roman Empire. And the next, and that was occurring in that fourth cycle, which points to a seventh cycle culmination. So the what we'll see in the next 20 years will be the emergence of a European superpower that has military aims.
And what can we see the total decline of this of the United States now, or what?
No, because you see, those countries that are born in the fourth cycle, and you know that 1774 period. Sorry about that. The 1774 period was the fourth cycle, and that's around when the United States was born. But those countries born around that time, they typically grow and then mature and achieve their fulfillment in the seventh cycle, not their demise. And that's a very, very consistent formula throughout history.
So we will. So what will we become at that point?
We might evolve into something else.
Anyways,
well, I think we will. We'll evolve into a even greater or bigger state. The template suggests unification with both Canada and Mexico, and it gives you a time of when that will occur. But I'll leave that for those people who want to read the book. But there are some big things occurring for both the United States and Europe and China. The Chinese relationship is a very, very critical one as well.
But we're looking at a North American Union then. You think that's going to go into effect here, according to your...
Yes. One consistent thing in the history that I've looked at is that economic union precedes political union, and the NAFTA agreement is an economic union that's preceding what will become a political union.
So do you see anywhere in your predictions the formulation of a new world order, a one world government?
No. In fact, you know, if you look at it, I looked for the appearance of some of these conspiratorial organizations when they came into being, this, that, and the other, and to see if they fit on this template in any way. And I think that they're a group of people who believe they're going to be all powerful and a huge threat, and the people who are parts of these organizations may believe the same things about themselves, but history has a way of always surprising them by the development of some leader who comes into power who they can't control. And I think that that's what we're going to be looking at once again, that there are forces that want to control economies, nations, the world, but they can't. Nobody could predict the superpower status of China over, you know, the next that occurred almost overnight. These things just happen outside of their calculation.
Now you have the coming of the Antichrist. Where is that? Have you predicted that kind of arrival anywhere in the near future?
Well, I will leave the dates for those who want to look at the book, but I'll tell you this. The Antichrist in the Bible and in the Template of Time, my book, is both a nation, or a group of nations, actually, and a person. When Daniel referred to the fourth kingdom, he was referring both to the king and to the kingdom. And he said that he likened it to legs of iron, homogeneous iron that became feet of clay and steel, or clay and iron, and that these toes were like 10 kings. In other words, you had a nation evolving into a confederacy of nations, a confederacy of kingdoms. And that's what we're seeing with the EU. And this is an interesting one. If you look at the 666 number and consider it maybe a time cycle, you multiply it times three, you get 1998. 1998 from 6 BC takes you to 1992, and that's when the EU was born.
That's when who was born?
The EU.
Oh, the EU.
The
oh,
EU.
Yeah.
The European Union. Interesting things, certainly, yeah. And we urge our listeners to get your book. And once again, it's the Template of Time, Our Destiny Decoded, and you've talked about some fascinating things, Tom, and we really appreciate all you've shared with us tonight.
Right, you can get that on Amazon.com or iUniverse.com.
Go to the website, thetemplateoftime.com, and that's where you'll find the ordering information.
There you go.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to another book from you.
Yeah.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank
okay.
you. Thank you so much, Tom. Okay, good night.
Good night. And, folks, we're going to...
Yeah, we're going to see Woody in the ring here in just a second as soon as Lila brings on the song.
Yep, here
it is.
Lila, how is my connection this evening?
It's pretty good.
Oh, glad to hear it. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, owners on the up, an open tiger, NHL playoffs, NBA playoffs, and, of course, baseball. Let's get down to it. The owners score. NFL owners got off the mat in a huge way last night. Pro football's labor war took a stunning swing in the direction when a federal appeals court let the owners continue the lockout indefinitely while casting serious doubt on the players' antitrust case against the league. By a 2-1 vote, a 3-judge panel from the 8th Circuit Court in St. Louis put a permanent freeze on the injunction by a lower court judge that had briefly lifted the lockout last month. As a result, the longest work stoppage in NFL history will continue unabated until the court hears a full appeal of the players' case, a process that starts June 3rd but likely won't be complete until late July. And if you're paying any attention, that's usually when NFL training camps are going on. This will either happen or the two sides will somehow reach a new collective bargaining agreement, obviously. But anyway, the owners also wrested away much of the leverage, enabling them to pursue what has seemed to be their strategy all along, testing the players' fortitude in the face of missed paychecks. Perhaps, not coincidentally, the ruling came down at the end of the first day of court-ordered mediation between the owners and the players in Minneapolis on the new CBA that, despite claims of a breakthrough offer from the owners, appears unlikely to break the stalemate. The decision from the decidedly conservative-leaning 8th Circuit is a stinging blow to the players, who until last night have been riding a wave of favorable court rulings since the lockout began in early March. Adding to the players' woes, the panel signaled in the decision yesterday that its sympathy lies with the owners and their claim that a Depression-era federal statute called the Norris LaGuardia Act negates the union's decision to decertify and pursue its case in court. The lower court judge, Susan Nelson, in the course of lifting the lockout last month, ruled the statute didn't apply and that the players' antitrust case was strong. The appeals panel strongly disagreed yesterday. Our present view is Judge Nelson's interpretation is unlikely to prevail, the court wrote in its decision. Youch. The judges also chided Nelson for not taking into account what they said was the damage her ruling inflicted on the owners. The district court gave little or no weight to the harm caused to the league by an injunction issued in the midst of an ongoing dispute over terms and conditions of employment, the panel said in the decision. The NFL's request for a stay of lockout that was granted yesterday means no football, according to the NFL Players Association. Players are in mediation and are trying to save the 2011 season. The court will hear the full appeal on June 3rd. Perhaps realizing federal judge David Doty could soon bring them back down to earth by imposing $700 million or more in damages in the lockout insurance case, the owners refrained from taking a victory lap last night. This situation seems to be deteriorating. I guess wrongly, that they would probably get this worked out because there's just so much money at stake. Money from the networks and sponsors. And, I mean, you could put an NFL game on any night of the week, and it would kill anything else that it goes up against. You know, ratings-wise, it just kills. The NFL just can't lose. But if you're not playing these games, the NFL just can't win. You know, there's a lot of money at stake. You know, basically we're looking at, you know, billionaires fighting with millionaires. And as I've said before, not every guy in the league is Peyton Manning or Drew Bledsoe or, you know, any of these, you know, guys who get all kinds of money and have played in the league for many years. A lot of guys play, you know, less than 3 or 4 years, and they're physically damaged for the rest of their life, you know, with a limp or a sore this or a sore that. So, you know, when they're in the league, they have to be able to have the ability to earn as much as possible, and they have to have good medical insurance thereafter. I mean, there's a lot of stuff at stake here. A lot of it has to do with veteran money instead of, you got a lot of these guys that come into the league and they sign these monster contracts and they do absolutely nothing. And then there's these veterans, you know, that have been in the league, you know, 5 or 6 years, they come up on another contract, and there's, like, no money left for them, and then they get chicken shit money, and they do a lot for the team, whereas you got these guys who have never played it down in the NFL just getting all this money, and then they're just a total waste. I mean, if I look back, just being a Bears fan, if I look back at all the running backs that we signed and gave money to that just were supposed to be the next Walter Payton, I mean, it's just ridiculous. It just never happened. This has never happened. You know, a guy would be good for a year or two or not even that. It was just, you know, so just a lot of money goes to a lot of the wrong places. And the players are trying to straighten that out, and I certainly don't blame them. And, you know, the owners, man, God, billionaires. But, hey, what are you going to do? It's definitely interesting. As I said, I'm definitely rooting for the players. A lot of people aren't. But, hey, everyone's entitled to their opinion. Okay, moving on. Tiger says he'll play in the Open. Tiger Woods says he didn't do any more damage to his left leg at the Players Championship and expects to play the U.S. Open next month. Woods only made it 9 holes last week at the Players, his shortest tournament ever, when he withdrew after 9 holes because of what he described as a chain reaction of pain from his left knee to his left Achilles and tightening in his calf. He did shoot a 42 on the front nine. As anybody knows, that once you hit 30, that Achilles is, always an issue. You got to really watch that. On his website yesterday, Woods says he irritated the knee and Achilles without making them worse. So the doctors have apparently advised rest, cold water therapy, and soft tissue treatment, which he said he had already been receiving. According to Woods, aggravating his injury is very disappointing. He will do whatever is necessary to play in the U.S. Open, and I'm hopeful I can be there to compete. U.S. Open, of course, takes place on June 16th and 19th at Congressional, a course on which Woods won the 2009 AT&T National. No word on how long it's going to take Woods to recover. His website said he was doubtful to play at the Memorial Tournament, which begins June 2nd, while he tried to strengthen his leg. It said playing before the U.S. Open would be a week-to-week decision. Although Woods, in his past history, he's never played the week before the U.S. Open. You know, obviously he wants to remain fresh. So I assume he'll just be doing all kinds of treatment and therapy and just, you know, maybe working on his chipping and putting and maybe his short game and stuff, and we'll just have to see. He won his last major in 2008 at the U.S. Open, and he had not played in a tournament in 2 months because of arthroscopic surgery on his left knee immediately after the Masters. Doctors later discovered stress fractures in his left leg. Woods wound up winning at Torrey Pines in a 19-hole playoff. So, you know, he can play injured. He is getting older. It's kind of funny. Years ago, everyone's like, oh, he's going to beat Jack Nicklaus's record and win, you know, X number of majors and so on and so forth. I was one of the few people who said, listen, you know, although it looks totally doable, man, let's not count your chickens before they hatch. You know, Jack Nicklaus was a great, great player, and you just don't win majors by accident. I can remember when Woods was in his heyday, you would either be able to gamble, you could take Woods or the rest of the field, and taking the rest of the field was not advised, not a good bet. Now, if it's the rest of the field or Woods, God, you're taking the rest of the field all day. Woods, as I last recall, has slipped to eighth in the world and moving faster on down the line. Personally, I don't think Woods is going to win that many more majors. The competition has caught up to him. Injuries have him faltering somewhat. And I'm not sure if he's just really back into it mentally. I don't know. You know what I mean? Before, I think it's, you know, he could carry his skills alone would be able to carry him. But I don't think his skills alone can now carry him. I think he's got to be in it in two different ways, mentally and physically. And I don't think he's there in both ways. I think he's lacking. So a little bit of Tiger Woods stuff there. All right, moving on. The NHL playoffs are taking place, and since nobody cares, I'm not going to bother covering it. All of like 17 people watch hockey, so whatever. You know, who cares? The NBA playoffs, however, are taking place, and a lot of people are watching the series that are banging out. Chicago finished off Atlanta in the Eastern Conference semifinals, and now they're going up against LeBron and the Miami Heat. The Bulls did manage to step out to a one-game victory. They won the other night in Chicago, 103-82. Pretty handy victory. As usual, Miami looked lackluster in the fourth. The Bulls, as I recall, have swept the season series from Miami during the regular season. Now, that's nice to say, but, you know, it's just the regular season. You know, the playoffs are definitely always different, but that's a pretty distinct advantage. I mean, I don't care whether it's regular season or not. If I beat you six times, I definitely got a leg up on you. Sure, you might be due to get a couple games, but you got to kind of like the Bulls in this series. Obviously, they have to hold home court. I mean, that's why they finished the number one seed. You know, they're great at home. Like any, you know, possible championship team, you got to be great at home. I think they have to win tomorrow night. You want to go up 2-0, going to Miami. You do not want to allow Miami to split. You cannot afford a split with Miami. Under no circumstances can you afford a split. In the Western Conference Finals, kind of interesting to see. It's Dallas against Oklahoma City. I believe it's the first time since 1988 that either the Lakers or the San Antonio Spurs were not being represented in the Western Conference Finals. So that's pretty interesting. Dallas has had a full 9 days layup. You know, they're a team of 30-somethings that have been brought together, you know, who've never won. You know, it's Dirk Nowitzki, Jason Kidd, and then, you know, the aging but rested Mavericks, or Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and the rapidly maturing Thunder. Now, you know, the Mavericks, as I said, are a collection of 30-somethings. You know, definitely they're bonded by the collective pursuit of their first championship. They have strong defense and a lot of scoring options, so you never know who share the top billing with Nowitzki. Dallas, you know, they looked real good. They swept the Lakers quite handily. And as I said, they've, you know, they've been waiting 9 days. So that's an awfully long layoff. With basketball, generally, even if you're an old team, you don't want to be laid off that for that much. But sometimes, it's, you know, it's good to recharge your batteries. But usually when you come out in the first half of that first game, there's a lot of rust. A lot of guys are clanging shots, you know, off the rim and everything else. But we'll have to see. Me personally, I think the rest probably did these guys some good. I think they're going to handle Oklahoma probably in 6 games. You know, Kevin Durant is great. You got to give the guy a lot of credit. Definitely a warrior. Tough player, you know. But I don't think Oklahoma City is gonna, you know, gonna be able to do it, you know. And you know, it took them 7 games, you know, from their last series. So I just don't see them getting past Dallas. I think it would be nice to see Dallas and Chicago in the finals. It would be great. I would love to see Miami get shut down by Chicago. I'm a Chicago fan, obviously, but frankly, I hate LeBron James and just everything he stands for. You know, I would just love for that team bus to go off a cliff. I guess it's a little harsh, but I really, actually, I would really kind of like it. So those are the breaks. Anyway, moving on. Onto some baseball stuff. Now, I had the opportunity to watch the Yankees and the Red Sox go at it over the weekend. The result was somewhat one-sided, and for me, being a Yankee fan, the games became somewhat unwatchable. I was quite disgusted with many aspects of the Yankee game. Primarily, the hitting is just absolutely piss poor, I must say. A lot of guys aren't coming through, which in a way is a good thing. I know how that sounds, but in a way it's a good thing. When you got like 4 or 5 guys that aren't hitting, that is not going to last. And baseball is a season of attrition, man. I mean, it's 162 games. It is a long season. And, you know, with the Yankee offense, these guys are definitely a team that is going to be able to reel off like 17 out of 21 or something. Like, absolutely no problem. They're going to be able to do that. But right now, they're just making it real difficult to root for them. You know, just, oh, God, they just look real pathetic at, you know, at the plate. And a lot of mental errors on the base pass. And, you know, seeing that ball roll under Alex's glove over the weekend was somewhat disheartening. It just made him look old. The timing of it was bad. You know, he just came up off on the ball a little bit, and that happens during the season a lot of times. But the timing of it and against the Red Sox, it just made the guys look worse. You know, it just made them look worse, especially after they'd gotten banged up by KC 2 out of 3 at home. I mean, that's just really embarrassing. And speaking of really embarrassing, I'm extremely embarrassed for Jorge Posada, who over the weekend decided to throw a little temper tantrum because, you know, he is batting 146, which is, you know, 54 points below the Mendoza line, and just looks absolutely horrendous at the plate. He has no hits against left-handers, and Girardi had the audacity to bat him 9th. Now, according to Jorge, you know, his later excuse was, oh, his back was bothering him. He needed a mental day off or whatever bullshit statement that he used. But listen, dude, you're being paid $13 million to be a DH. All you got to do is hit the freaking baseball. That's it. $13 million. You're not behind the plate anymore. You're not getting into it with the pitchers anymore. Nothing. All you got to do is hit the baseball. And from both sides of the plate, you got to be able to hit righties and lefties. I don't need 2 DHs on my team, one that can hit righties and one that can hit lefties. That's not how it works. I need just one guy that can hit and can hit, no, I don't know, maybe 50 points over the Mendoza line instead of, like, 54 points under the Mendoza line. So once Posada saw himself batting 9th, he opted out of the lineup. You know, Posada, nobody likes a quitter. Me, personally, they always say, who would you rather have on your team, a quitter or a cheater, like a guy who does PEDs or a quitter? Now, me, personally, I would pick a cheater over a quitter any day. At least a cheater wants to win. A quitter just gives up. I mean, that's unacceptable. Now, I think it's kind of interesting how Derek Jeter took his back. Now, I'm not exactly sure if Derek Jeter had exactly the full, you know, the full knowledge of what exactly transpired. You know, he refers to Posada as his brother, so on and so forth. But frankly, I find it a little hard to believe that Derek Jeter, the consummate winner, the guy who I have a picture of on my wall, and signed, by the way, autographed, diving into the stands to catch a foul ball hit by some scumbag Red Sox player, dives into the stands to give up his body just to catch a ball, would take the back of a guy who says, oh, I'm batting 9th, I don't want to play. I really find that hard to believe. Also, I would love to know what the rest of the guys in the locker room are thinking. I'm talking about A-Rod. I'm talking about Cano. I'm talking about some of the pitchers. Guys who, you know, probably don't remember a lot of Posada's heroics from so far back. You know, Posada was a great, I'll give Posada his due, great Yankee, great catcher, so on and so forth. But a lot of his bigger days are way behind him. I was surprised when the Yankees gave him this contract, frankly. I would have kept it a year shorter, but whatever. But he got paid, and he got paid. And he's getting paid $13 million. Now, from what I'm hearing, if he doesn't start hitting within the next 2 weeks, and this is stuff that I've just heard from various sports people, that the Yankees are going to cut him. So if he doesn't get that average over the next week, Posada probably may not be rocking pinstripes for the rest of the season. Frankly, I think it would be great for the team. I would bring Montero up, bring the kid up, let him DH. He's young. This team needs some youth. I think it would shake up the rest of these guys. Something has to be done. It cannot go on any longer like this. So my message to Posada is, hey, homeboy, start producing or start packing. One or the other, produce or pack. Now, on Saturday, apparently, he said he wanted out. Now, he took that back, I guess. You know, cooler heads prevailed. But, you know, he seems to be squared off against Cashman and Girardi. And, you know, obviously, as I said, Jeter took his back. Jeter is still stinging from his contract negotiations, you know, over the winter. He still has a little burn under his saddle there against Cashman. So I think any opportunity to kind of rail against your organization a little bit, you know, within reason, I think Jeter's going to take. It's a shame. I used to really love Jeter, and, you know, he never says anything in interviews and so on and so forth. But I don't know. Just the turn that he's taking, I'm liking him a little bit less, which is kind of sad. And I'm going to end on that note. So that's it for this week. Summertime is coming. Let's everybody just hope and enjoy for some warm weather. Shout out to all my woodheads out there. Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, especially my partner, Money Mike, Greg at AFS. That's it for this week.
And good night. Thank you, Woody. minutes. I think probably John Brennan will be on the line with us. But in the meantime, do we have...
I thought we could do another song if you'd like, just for a minute. I don't know.
I want to go back to our articles. There was some more that I wanted to take a look at.
Okay. Hang on a second. All right. We've got...
Let's see. We had some other things that we wanted to...
Yeah.
There's a secret ground war going on in Libya.
UN Security Council Resolution 1973 only passed because Moscow and Beijing abstained, and this was a tactical move meant to limit the war. If the resolution had been vetoed by Russia and China, in all likelihood, the U.S., Britain, France, Italy, or members of NATO would have resorted to other means, including an outright invasion. But abstaining and getting the NATO powers to vocally invest themselves to UN Resolution 1973 and to hide behind it, Moscow, Beijing managed to limit the options of the Pentagon and NATO.
Okay.
And but now they're going into a ground war because they limited the powers.
Let's see if there's any more to that.
The efforts of Moscow and Beijing, however, not hindered Washington and its NATO allies from breaching international law or UN Resolution 1973. We don't pay attention to any of those resolutions.
No.
We go there thinking we should get them to verify.
And then
do everything against the UN resolutions. It's bullshit. But
Washington has casually admitted that the Central Intelligence Agency was on the ground supporting rebel forces. According to Washington, the involvement of U.S. intelligence agents in Libya started as soon as the U.S. embassy in Tripoli was closed on February 25th of 2011, is the date of the U.S. embassy in Tripoli was reported as being closed. This is a casual omission that the United States has violated international law and was operated on the ground in Libya before any UN approval. Moreover, Italy has opened its military base to use by the U.S., Britain, and France before any UN approval by repudiating its non-aggression pact with Libya on February 27, 2011. In other words, the war against Libya had already begun.
Unnamed U.S. officials have told Reuters that U.S. intelligence operations were underway in Libya before President Obama signed the secret order in March 2011 that authorized covert U.S. actions against the Libyan government. The U.S. was not alone in operating in Libya. It has been reported that dozens of British agents and commandos from MI6, the Special Air Services Unit, and the Special Boat Services Unit were also operating inside Libya. These foreign forces in Libya were sent to prepare for the war by selecting targets to be bombed. And even before the attacks were launched, both Britain and France even announced plans in November 2010 for war games that envisioned attacking Libya under the exercise codename Southland. And the
British and French military assets being mobilized for these drills ended up being used to attack Libya. November 2010, according to the Italian journalist Franco Becci's of Italy's Libero, also happened to be the time that Paris started planning for the regime change in Libya. Even if the November 2010 war games and the Italian article about regime change plans are dismissed, a war with Libya was intended from the outset of the crises. Before the assault on Libya started, the Pentagon and its NATO allies had mobilized an excessive amount of military assets that well beyond the needs of any evacuation operations in Libya. In the words of the British Defense Minister Liam Fox, as we have seen in Libya in the past 96 hours, Britain still has the military capability to protect British interests. At a time when the commercial sector was unable or unwilling to fly, the British government used a range of military assets, including naval warships, each with a detachment of Royal Marines and C-130 Hercules aircraft, to evacuate hundreds of Britons and citizens from dozens of other countries.
This sounds like another Downing Street mess with Britain and the U.S. planning this all.
In fact, British armed forces have been leading the way with HMS Cumberland being the first military asset from any country to enter and evacuate citizens from the Libya city of Benghazi. Days later, the British Ministry of Defense acknowledged the British troops were on standby, waiting to enter Libyan territory. I mean, this article goes on.
It's a long article,
but it tells you that there was nothing happened suddenly.
No. This has been planned, and this is NATO's secret ground war in Libya.
This is from Research.
GlobalResearch.ca. Check it out. Let's see, we got Johnny.
No, he's not on yet.
Okay.
Now, this is one that's really annoying. Israel to maintain U.S. helicopters. And that annoys me. Go down to this one. The United States Army has contracted an Israeli defense industry giant to perform the maintenance work and upgrading of parts for the Apache and Black Hawk helicopters. The five-year deal was signed with Israel's TAT Technologies, with which the U.S. military has had decades of closing deals. UPI reported on Monday, the Army has placed USD $4.3 million purchase order with the company, and the contract's value may reach U.S. dollars of $20 million over its course.
Now, why don't they...
What about an American company?
Sarkozy, which was...
Sikorsky.
Sikorsky, which built these damn things, you know?
No, so you give it to some foreign company.
Yeah, just like they're giving...
We pay taxes...
Yeah, but like it's like giving Britain the maintenance of the president's helicopter.
Yeah, you know, that annoyed me too.
That was insane. And,
here's another insane deal.
We're just selling out everything, man. You know, American people are getting fucked up the wazoo single day by their own government. It's just sick.
When they talk about jobs, why don't you start maintaining jobs by having us maintain our own property?
Exactly.
John Brennan is on the line with us,
Hey, Johnny,
we'll be talking
doing?
About environmental things. John, how are you?
Good evening, Lila. Good evening, Leo. How's it going tonight?
Oh, great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm a bit late getting myself together here, so I'm trying to come up with some interesting subjects to talk about tonight. Normally, like you say, I do environmental things, but I may sometimes veer off environmental things and talk about some other interesting events around the world. But I might talk a little bit tonight about the possibility of a huge earthquake in the New Madrid Fault area, basically near Tennessee. In that area. Have you talked about that tonight, earlier on your show?
No, we haven't mentioned that at all. Please elaborate on that.
Okay, well, there's basically, as you all know about what happened with the tornadoes a few weeks ago, wiped out huge parts of the South and disrupted a lot of the poultry-producing facilities, so you might not be able to get your chicken at McDonald's or Wendy's very shortly, or perhaps even chicken at the store could become a prized possession due to the facilities, which were the biggest ones in the country in that area, where I forget how many hundred tornadoes touched down all at one time. Very, very odd. And, of course, we've spoken many, many times about the chemtrails, which are part of the weather modification that is engaged in by the United States and by other countries, I have to emphasize. We have a thing called a HAARP facility. That's not the harp the angels play. This is the HAARP. That's an abbreviation for the High Active Auroral Research Project. And the most well-known one that people speak about is up in Gaycona, Alaska. And it's basically a military facility on a huge acreage, like 48 acres or something, and it has this arrayed antennas over many acres, which beam wattage and frequencies into the ionosphere, which can basically boil the atmosphere way, way high up there, almost at the bridge or the brink of where we touch onto space, can create a vacuum. And it has the ability to basically disrupt the jet stream, which controls most of the weather around the world. So once you can control the jet stream, you can control a lot of the weather patterns, and you can block the patterns, and you can release them all of a sudden. You can cause frequencies that will shake the internals of the Earth. And a lot of this is Nikola Tesla technology. And actually, the History Channel did a number, well, not the History Channel, and the Discovery Channel have done various episodes about the HARP facility, weather modification. There was one series called That's Impossible, and Weather Warfare was the subtitle. Very interesting to see that they revealed a lot of what we talk about here, and we might be considered conspiracy theorists, but their own patents and their own people, you know, their generals and stuff will come on and tell you, yeah, we have the facility up there, but we would never do anything. So they can deny, it's plausible deniability, they can deny that it can cause any of this earthquakes or anything. But right on the History Channel, they gave a laboratory experiment of showing like a large brick on a sandbank with another sort of a wedge underneath it, and they created the vibration, the frequency, somewhat similar, I suppose, to when an opera singer is able to get hit the high pitch and crack a window, or certain sounds can be created by machinery and will crack a glass. Sound has energy and a vibration, and in the same sort of way of thinking, the military at its highest levels, you know, don't forget, we're not 1965 anymore. We all don't know how our cell phones work, but they work. You can call somebody in Ireland on a cell phone, and the same people who can design that technology can absolutely, very simply, design a system to be able to cause an earthquake. And they may have stumbled upon the way to do this, you know, when they were looking for oil under the oceans and minerals, you know, using, I guess, satellite to Earth tomography sort of scans. They accidentally did trigger earthquakes, and then they began to use it for military purposes. So the upcoming event that everybody in the alternative media knows about, if you're a new listener to this show, you might not be aware of even what the new Madrid fault is. And I have a short video clip here from the BBC. It's about 9 minutes, 10 minutes long. Will we have time to play that?
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Are you going to play it right now?
I'm going to play it right now, yeah. And you can cut me off.
Go ahead.
It's going to give you a history of the New Madrid Fault.
Okay. That would be interesting.
Okay.
When you think about earthquakes, what normally comes to mind are places like California and Alaska or some far-off distant land, but certainly not right here in the state of Tennessee, not right here in our own backyard. But the truth is, the largest earthquakes in the history of North America occurred on the western edge of the state of Tennessee. Geologists call this area the New Madrid Fault Zone. Its nickname is the Sleeping Giant. It's 20 times the size of the San Andreas Fault Zone. It's located in the central portion of the United States. It covers a 5-state region. It's the home of millions of people. It's the central economic hub for the entire nation. Some of the nation's largest distributors and manufacturers are located there. It's the heartland of America. And it's also the Bible Belt. The experts are saying this sleeping giant may be showing signs of waking up. Signs.
And I'll just cut in here. The experts are saying the signs of it waking up. Well, they're going to wake it up by artificial forces to take out the heartland of America. And the signs of this HARP being turned on have been sensed by people who monitor it. It's absolutely at full belt right now. But anyway, I just want to...
Is this the same area that's being flooded by the Mississippi right now?
Yeah, it's in and around the same area. And incidentally, Edgar Casey, he was a psychic, a seer. He actually said that this would happen as well. So I don't know how, and he didn't give a timeline, but he said it would basically end up to be an earthquake that would crack the United States down the middle. And it's kind of symbolic, you know, breaking the heart of America, the heartland of America. It's very sad. The devastation that this earthquake will cause will affect us all. Perhaps this country could end up in a famine-type situation or food shortages, and that's been talked about before. Now it's all starting to come together. Anyway, I'll let this video play on a little further, and we'll talk again at a time.
Geologists and seismologists from all over the globe are expressing concern over the vulnerability of this region. Should there be another earthquake equal to or greater than those of the past, the devastation would be cataclysmic and of biblical proportion. In other words, the recovery process would take decades, and obviously things would never be the same again. On December 16, 1811, through February the 7th, 1812, within a 54-day time frame, four major earthquakes struck the center of the United States along the banks of the Mississippi River on the western edge of the state of Tennessee. The first earthquake occurred at 2:15 a.m. on December the 16th, 1811, and registered at a level 8.2. Through the early morning hours, there were a total of 27 aftershocks, and 6 hours later at 8:15 a.m., the second earthquake of the same magnitude as the first struck again, registering at a level 8.2. The riverbed under the Mississippi opened and closed with fissures, causing massive tidal waves and reversed the flow of the mighty Mississippi, destroying everything in its path. A third quake occurred on January 23, 1812, and registered an 8.1 and caused ground warping, fissures, severe landslides, ejections, and caving in of stream banks. But on February the 7th, 1812, the earth shook like never before, with twice the intensity and energy of the previous quakes, registering at a level 9, and this quake was felt in 23 states and 1,000 miles away. The massive quake occurred at the future site of what is now the location of Memphis, Tennessee. There was uplift along the reverse fault segment that created waterfalls on the Mississippi River. A surge of water went upstream and created the Real Foot Lake, and at the same time forming a depression that would later become Lake Caddo in northeastern Texas. It moved furniture and knocked down chimneys in Jefferson, Indiana. Homes were destroyed all along the Mississippi Valley, from Louisiana to as far north as Cincinnati, Ohio. In Lebanon, Ohio, residents fled their homes. In Missouri, people claimed the shaking lasted for 12 minutes. In Kentucky, it disrupted the flow of the river at the Kentucky Bend. On the other side of the Appalachian Mountain chain, it sloshed well water and shook houses and knocked plaster off the walls of towns like Columbia and Charleston, South Carolina. The region settled down until 1895, when another quake struck at level 6.0. And since then, things have been relatively quiet, even though there are hundreds of small earthquakes registered each year in the region, most of which are too small to be felt. In an article published in USA Today on August 8, 2005, a spokesperson for the U.S. Geological Survey was quoted as saying, "Even if earthquakes happen somewhat less frequently here, they can cause damage over a much bigger area. That's because seismic waves travel farther and very cold, very old, and hard crust under the central USA. Compared with the 1906 earthquake that all but destroyed San Francisco, the New Madrid quake had strong shaking over about 20 times as much area." He states further that the USGS calculates a 40% chance of a major earthquake of magnitude 6.0 or greater within the next 35 years, and a 10% chance of a quake the size of the ones that made the New Madrid famous. The USGS was also quoted as saying a repeat today of the earthquakes of 1811, 1812 would cause widespread loss of human life and billions of dollars in property damage.
And it would so suit the globalists perfectly well in their depopulation plans.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's for sure.
My time I've got left here, I'm going to maybe just clip the video at this point. It was a little bit of a history of the natural events that have happened there, but we didn't have the HAARP facility that's capable of causing earthquakes back then. And the other that we did not have was we did not have the series of earthquakes occurring all over the world. I mean, huge amounts, some that are not even reported on our daily news today using the internet. You know, we've had the Haiti, Japan. I mean, you go back 2 or 3 years ago, Iran, the tsunami that happened in Indonesia. The list is just absolutely astonishing. Even if you take into account that our news reporting is more, you know, it's faster than it was back in the 1800s. The historic records, when you go through them, are showing that the rate of seismic events around the world and general weather events going totally berserk has gone ballistically out of control. So something is amiss. And we could just say it's the God that's causing it, but we know that the weather modification is being done. There's even companies called Weather Modification Inc. Go online. Their phone number is in North Dakota there. It'll come right up. And you know, that's just a commercial company. When you take the military aspects of that, we're into a whole other scenario. But anyway, I'm looking at my time here. I have a couple of other stories I'd like to hit on.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
And this is completely changing gear here to something that I thought might be of interest. This is about the $5 fees might be coming to the ATMs near you. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, I heard about this. It could be up to $5, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, JP Morgan Chase and other banks are trying to recoup approximately $30 billion a year that they, you know, lost. And then this will be done in overdraft and fee increases, you know, by testing $5 ATM fees. And this was said by a consumer action spokesman, Joe Ridout. He told this to CNBC. The banks have historically been reliant on overdraft fees, he said, so they're coming up now with new ways to make up the difference. He said higher ATM fees and other rising costs penalize all depositors. Nessa Fedis, a spokeswoman with the American College of Consumer Financial Services, agreed there are enormous pressures on banks because of lost revenue. I suppose we're supposed to cry for them at this point, the poor banks, you know.
I really feel sad about
that.
Don't
you have trouble squeezing out a tear for them, huh?
I really am trying hard here. She insisted that most people don't pay ATM fees, only non-consumers who otherwise pay nothing to contribute to the cost of providing the ATMs pay the fee. That is fair, because otherwise they are not contributing to the cost of providing the service. She blamed the price controls that the government is imposing for drastically limiting debit card interchange fees. Those debit
but she's a lobbyist for the banks, obviously, right?
Oh, absolutely. But I'll cut to the chase here. Even on CNBC, let you hear the clip that they played on TV.
Okay.
Sorry, they had a slight ad came in here before. I had it queued up, but I have to wait 10 seconds for the ads to go by before the clip will come up from CNBC. You know how they do it these days.
Yep.
All right, should be here right now. Here we go.
Jamie Dimon is looking for new ways to make money for JP Morgan. Right now, his bank is testing higher ATM fees, $5 for customers that aren't from JP Morgan. In Illinois, if you use the JPM Chase.
It starts with one bank, and it'll be in your local bank before you know it.
Profits from already lucrative fees. The Wall Street Journal reports that banks as a group made as much as $7.1 billion last year on ATM fees. It's great money if you can get it. So is there justification for this seeming gouging or not? Joining us is Joe Ridout, spokesperson for Consumer Action, and Nessa Fedis, the vice president and senior counsel at the American Bankers Association. Nessa, let me, assuming that you're going to be able to make the case for this or in a position to do so, what makes the case for ATM fees of $5? To many people, that just really sounds like gouging.
Well, let's step back a minute, and we want to be very clear here. Everyone knows that they do not have to pay an ATM fee so long as they use an ATM that's connected to or owned by their bank. So most people don't pay ATM fees. It's only non-customers who otherwise would pay nothing for to contribute to the cost of providing the ATM who have to pay the fee. And that's fair, because otherwise they're not contributing to the cost of providing the service.
Okay, that makes sense. But, Joe, you know, a week ago or a year ago it was $1. Now all of a sudden it's $5. Did the cost of servicing that customer who's not from Chase go up that much?
Good point.
Of course not. But I think there's a couple of factors at work here. One, these new fees are coming from banks that historically have been very reliant on overdraft fees. And with the disappearance of this approximately $30 billion a year in overdraft income, they're coming up with new ways to make up the difference. So you're seeing new ATM fees that are skyrocketing by Chase. Bank of America has, with one of its accounts, charging you people $8.95 if you speak with a teller for one of its accounts. And other banks are raising mandatory monthly minimums. But what they all have in common is that these are the banks that were reliant on overdraft income. In other words, the biggest banks.
Nessa, can't they come up with something, though, a new service that actually adds a lot more value,
well,
to come up with that lost income as opposed to just starting to hike fees everywhere else?
Well, first of all, Joe is correct. There are enormous pressures on banks because of lost revenue. In part, that's because of new regulations that price controls, government price controls that the government is imposing.
I'm going to cut it here. There's blah, blah, blah. You get the general idea. They're just going to keep coming up with ideas to rip off you and me and the listeners of this show.
How about 95 charge to talk to a live person?
Oh, yeah. Probably be $10 by the time I put the phone down, you know. They just
it's like if you have to talk to Dell about your computer, if you want an English-speaking person, all right?
Expensive.
It costs you $60.
Right.
If you want to speak to an Indian, all right, who can't speak English,
mm-hmm.
It's free.
Well, I just thought I'd at least give people a heads up to beware that these gouging bank
threats
are doing what they're doing. So be prepared to speak out. If everybody stands up and says no, it helps. And that's basically the point I'm trying to make in giving you the brief clip I did here and when I'm talking about it. There's one
you
other
take your
story.
Money out of banks that are doing that. Go to a different bank.
Right. Well, you all know about the story about the guy who was at Dominique Strauss-Kahn. The guy he's accused of the sexual assault.
Yep.
That might be a story to distract from another story. And this is kind of breaking news. Did you hear about Israel attacking the humanitarian ship in Gaza?
Yes.
You did? Did you talk about that tonight?
We didn't have a chance to, but yes, they attacked the Rachel Corrie.
That's right, the spirit of Rachel Corrie. That was officially known as the Finch, and it was carrying humanitarian cargo to Gaza, was attacked by an Israeli naval patrol within the so-called Palestinian Security Zone, May 15th. So I thought perhaps, you know, that would be a story you'd want to hear. Is that something you want to talk about? Or?
Oh, sure. That was one that we were going to talk about, but we ran out of time.
Okay.
It's a very good story, and we have a friend who's going to be going on the next humanitarian effort.
You know Gail.
Gail Corrie Tonsing?
Yes, and I hope Gail's listening to this. I'm sure she knows about this already anyway.
Well, she's going on a humanitarian trip to Gaza in June. She'll be leaving from Greece on June 22nd.
Wow. Well, I hope Gail understands that what she's dealing with here are basically people who are prepared to shoot any man, woman, or child right between the eyes without even thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm very...
Especially if you're doing humanitarian help for the Palestinians.
Yep.
They have special hatred for you if you're doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Going in there unarmed is very foolish, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They do not care, whether you're armed or not. They will shoot you anyway. So to go in unarmed, it is absolutely, you know, it's like going to a gunfight with a knife.
Just going to a gunfight.
That's all I'm trying to say. You must think twice about it. because you're dealing with psychopathic soldiers who are brainwashed to just shoot to kill. That's what they are.
Yeah.
They've done it in the past. They've shot people in the head right on the humanitarian boats before. So, well, participating in this mission are the anti-war activists and journalists, consisting of 7 Malaysians. There's 2 Irish people. Glad to hear that. 2 Indians, and there's 1 Canadian. And the Center for Research and Globalization is a partner in this endeavor. And Global Researches, that's Canada, Julie Levesque is on board the Rachel Corrie also. The cargo ship, the Spirit of Rachel Corrie, and Rachel Corrie, for those who don't know, was a 23-year-old American citizen who stood up against the vicious thug Israeli army, Jewish Israeli army, and they ran her over with a bulldozer and basically reversed over to make sure she was dead. And they will do so to anybody else as well. So whether you're on a ship, whatever, you can't get a bulldozer over you, but they would if they could. Well, this ship is carrying 7.5 kilometers of UPVC, that's plastic sewage pipes, to help restore the devastated sewage system in Gaza. The ship was named, like I just said, after the courageous American activist. She was crushed and killed by the Israeli bulldozer, and that was in 2003. And that was trying to prevent the demolition of another Palestinian home. Let me see what else I can say. The Spirit of Rachel Corrie entered the Gazan waters without being detected. Then the Israeli Navy, with its radar equipment and advanced communications technology, was unaware of the Spirit of Rachel Corrie. They were unprepared. They had received no prior information of the Rachel Corrie mission, which had been planned for several months and scheduled to arrive off the coast of Gaza on the day of the Nakab commemoration. Ironically, the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, was unaware of this mission. So it was very secretive, very well done. The Israeli naval vessels acted in an improvised fashion without prior knowledge or intelligence. And there was no indication that they had received precise instructions from the Israeli government. At the time of the attack, the passengers on board were under the impression that the ship was still in international waters, when in fact, this is printed kind of wrong here. I haven't read this before. As I read it, at the time of the attack, the passengers on board were under the impression that the ship was still in international waters, when in fact it was 1 mile inside the Palestinian security zone, namely in Gaza territorial waters, within a short distance of the Gaza coastline. This was an important accomplishment. Indicated below is the initial report sent to Global Research, which is where I'm reading this from. At 10:54 Eastern Time, the Spirit of Rachel Corrie was intercepted by the Israeli ship and an Egyptian ship in international waters. 10:54, Gaza, 5:54 a.m., we have been intercepted by Israeli ship and Egyptian ship. We are disobeying the orders and sailing ahead to Gaza. One Israeli warship coming at us very fast. We are in international waters, therefore they have no right to attack us. We are still sailing ahead. They are opening fire across our ship. We are still sailing ahead. They are shooting all over the place. We can't continue. They circled our ship twice and fired across our ship machine guns. No one was injured. One of the fishing nets caught the propeller, so we can't move now. The Israeli ship was coming from one end and the Egyptian ship was coming from the other end, firing. We are just stalled now. Everybody is okay. No one is injured. The following exchange took place between the Israeli Navy and the ship, as reported by the Free Malaysian Today journalist on board the ship, the Rachel Corrie. Israeli Army, this is a warning shot. Turn around. Captain Jael Mansour, we are unarmed civilians on a humanitarian mission to Gaza, Israeli Army. This is a closed military zone. It's a violation. Turn around. Mansour, we will continue the mission. The Israelis then headed to the back of the aid vessel and released a second warning shot into the air. Graham, this is a violation of international law. We are on a peaceful mission and unarmed. Israeli Army, Turn around, we will fire again. Graham, we are firing towards, you are firing towards unarmed civilians.
Israel. Yeah, you got to wonder what would have happened to those bastards if somebody would have shot all the Israeli bricks that got in that boat, you know?
Exactly.
Would that be an international incident? I mean, what they did was an act of piracy, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Keep reading, John. What happened next?
Anyway, the Israeli Navy, after quite a confrontation back and forth, had contacted the Spirit of Rachel Corrie ship. They were informed regarding the nature of the cargo and that the crew and passengers were unarmed civilians. The warning attack was aggressive, using automatic weapons. Two Israeli naval patrol boats armed with machine guns were deployed. The Israelis also opened fire on a Palestinian fishing boat, which was within the Gaza territorial waters. Following the initial warning attack, they ordered the boat to turn back. Turn around or we'll shoot. Whoever wants the ship change course as demanded by the Israeli commandos. They continued firing on the ship. They started shooting to kill. Just as I said, that's how these guys operate. They like to.
Yep.
The Egyptian Navy ship, while communication with the Navy, Israeli Navy, was instrumental in escorting the ship to safe haven. The crew of the Egyptian ship were supportive in ensuring the safety of the crew and the passengers of the humanitarian vessel. And here I'm going to say, if it hadn't been for the Egyptian vessel, Navy, all those people would be dead, in my opinion, in my humble opinion. So
where did they escort them to?
Let's see where they. I'm just going to read the end of this here now. There was a communication between the Israeli and Egyptian ships, and the Israelis thanked the Egyptian ship for having intervened. Oh, I bet they did. They were probably glad they were there because they didn't have to kill everybody, because otherwise they would have. Spirit of Rachel Corrie's ship, its crew and passengers are now in Egyptian territorial water, anchored off the Egyptian port of Al Arish, within a short distance of Gaza territorial waters. It's essential at this stage to mobilize worldwide in support for the people of this ship, the Spirit of Rachel Corrie, and to break the blockade, open up the Gaza territorial waters to aid and trade, and also to use this opportunity to open the land border between Egypt and Gaza. And the humanitarian convoy is of significance in the progress of rehabilitation of Gaza's public health infrastructure, including its sewage system, which was partially destroyed by Israeli bombings under Operation Cast Lead. You remember that one, eh?
Yes, I do.
On the 27th of December 2008, the Israeli army, they launched this Operation Cast Lead, which not only killed some 1,400 Palestinians, but it also destroyed vital infrastructure, leaving the Gazans with critical water and sewage problems. Repair of the infrastructure has proved impossible, as the Israelis have prevented the entry of construction materials and workers and fuel to resolve the dire situation. This is quite a long article, and I see we're at the top of the hour here, so
time is kind of over. But I think we get the point there. It's the Israelis are really the aggressors in this situation. They're trying to prevent any kind of humanitarian aid to Gaza.
And anybody who tries to be humanitarian will be shot on sight if they can get away with it.
That's right. And so
most
far
of the
they
time
have...
they're successful.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think these people are heroic in their efforts to try to help the Gazan people.
Absolutely.
You know, they're living in a horrible situation. I mean, it's like being in a concentration camp.
Right. I almost think, you know, I really do, like you said, feel very enlightened and you know, a great hope by people like Gail going there. But I think to go there without an escort of people with certainly video cameras, if you're not going to bring weapons to defend yourself, you've got to bring some sort of way to report. You need to go with several ships. You know, generally it seems that the Israelis will attack with one naval vessel, and do a hell of a job on you. You know, we know they took the USS Liberty down with planes and with a couple of Israeli ships and got away with it. So a small humanitarian vessel is nothing to them. But certainly when the eyes of the world go on them, that changes everything.
Well, I hope when Gail goes, there'll be 59 other Americans. It's an American contingent of people who want to bring humanitarian aid to the Gaza, that there's a lot of publicity around it so that they'll be safe.
Yeah, and it would be great if people like it would get some good video shots and make sure that they hide the cameras if there's a boarding of the ship. You know, make sure you've got them hidden so that somehow or other they can be gotten to the rest of us to see what's really going on.
So I certainly hope so. Well, I want to thank you, John. We're after our time tonight, and I want to thank you for what you've brought us. You always bring us some interesting news, and I hope we'll be talking to you next week.
Yeah, I look forward to it again, and thank you for having me on.
Well, we enjoy having you on. Good night.
Have a good night.
Good night, Leo. Good night, Lila, and all the listeners.
All right. For all of you, please join us tomorrow night when we get a little more involved here with different news and views. We got a bunch of great articles I want to bring up to you, some of which you haven't heard tonight. I didn't have a chance to talk about them tonight. And that's about it. So join us tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, right here.
And we'll play our ending music, and good night, and talk to you tomorrow.